Backseat Producers, episode 174, Schindler's List.
We choose to refer to that as the moronic time.
When you have free labor, you will be an amazing businessman.
Two minutes of ABC just jerking off all over everything. You need to slim down a little bit. You need to lay off the cheeseburgers, Batman. Hey, this is Tony.
Hey, this is Daryl.
And this is Adam.
Come on! Well done. We are the Backseat Producers. Oh, this is going to be a laugh riot.
I hope so. Yeah, it's
what
one
we
of
promised
the
last week.
Films ever made.
It's what was promised last week. You weren't here. You missed.
I wasn't here.
You missed,
I missed it.
The lovely Elizabeth last week, and when we talked about Jaws.
Yeah,
so, we promised that. This week's episode will be a laugh riot.
Yes.
Schindler's List.
Yes, the comedy short. Schindler's List.
Oh, it is far from either of those.
Right. So, what'd you think?
I liked it. I noticed a lot more flaws in it this time when I watched it. I watched it with a more critical eye. To be honest, I think I've only seen it one other time watching it straight through. It's one of those movies that it's a good movie, but just
the
to
subject
watch
matter
it,
is a bit, yeah, it's just, a bit hard to take more than once.
You just don't feel the need to revisit some of the subject matter. But I kind of found some of the same problems with it as I sat back and thought about it, as I found with
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, Private Ryan. So, but we'll get into that. So, what do you think?
Go to him first.
Well, just I thought it was just the same powerful movie as I remember seeing it. I mean, how can you categorize the Holocaust in 3 hours? It's
right.
Kind of tough.
Yeah.
I mean, but I thought it has just that same amount of pull. The first time I watched it back in 93, and like Tony mentioned, this is a hard movie to watch a second time because of the rather depressing subject matter. Even though it's supposed to be inspirational and uplifting, it's just kind of like, it's like dark beer. It's an acquired taste. I mean, you can sit here and pull it apart, all the innovative things that Spielberg did in terms of his camera work, which was somewhat unusual for him at that time. Mm-hmm. Here he went from all these light, airy, happy movies to this very deep, dark subject in seemingly one step. And it was able to pull it off.
I think it's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I like it for a lot of different reasons. I this sounds probably worse than it's going to come out, or whatever, the opposite, but you know what I'm saying. I think the subject matter is compelling because it's being told from the perspective of a guy who's just a businessman, and mm-hmm. I think right off the bat, that makes the movie more interesting than if it was just a movie about the Holocaust.
Yes.
And I think
from the perspective of the characters involved.
Right. And I think the character, which has a lot to do with how well Liam Neeson did in the role,
mm-hmm.
was interesting enough and three-dimensional enough that you could write any movie about this character, be it in the Holocaust or not, and it would have been a compelling movie because the character of Oscar Schindler was so good.
Yeah.
And it really makes the movie a cut above most other war movies I've ever seen because it is a character drama in a war movie as opposed to the vice versa where you have the cardboard cutout characters like the ones in Private Ryan that
right.
happen to be in a war movie.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's really great. I'd put it probably, I mean, it's probably in my top three Spielberg movies, and I think it would probably, if I had to make a list of the top 50 movies ever made, I mean, I think it would make the cut. I think it would
oh,
be
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
I don't disagree. It's phenomenal, you know?
I don't disagree at all. And while I do have some flaws with the movie, I think... Let me just jump right in and start analyzing the movie. I think where Schindler's List succeeds, where Private Ryan failed me, was that to me, Private Ryan felt like it wanted to be a character study in certain aspects, but it just couldn't be because there was too much going on. There wasn't enough character to focus on because there was too many characters really to focus on.
Yeah.
Where this one felt like a character study, and it was. It was very definitely a character study. And there was a couple of different characters that it focused on at different points, but primarily it was Oscar Schindler's story, and it focused on that character, and as flawed and as interesting as he was, it really did show you that character and gave him an arc.
Yeah.
That you can very easily follow. If you want to look at for that aspect, you can very clearly delineate a character arc for Oscar Schindler. It's real easy to track. It's this is like textbook.
Yeah, he changes over the course of the movie. He moves from this like rather scheming businessman to suddenly realizing, hey, this isn't just about the dollars and cents anymore.
Right. Right. Though it doesn't miraculously erase all his flaws. And that's what I like about the character of Oscar Schindler. Even in the end, even after everything that happens, he's still a flawed person. I mean, he's still not and which is kind of an interesting ironic tragedy is that in the end everybody wants to put him on this pedestal and he doesn't see it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty... The end is a little creaky just because it has one of those Spielbergian moments where you kind of feel like the moment's implicit and it shouldn't be explicit.
Right.
Where this could have saved five people, this could have saved nine people. I mean, I think everyone kind of got that point, so I think it's a little bit of the... But maybe we needed to see it to see that Oscar Schindler fully understood the point.
Right.
Because maybe that's really what it's about, so... I mean, in some ways, it's effective, but I just think that as a character piece, it's really strong. It's almost strong in spite of the Holocaust stuff in it, because the Holocaust stuff is so overwhelming and so
it detracts,
disturbing.
It actually detracts from the story
in a way. Yeah, even though the purpose of the story almost is to serve those images.
Yes,
in a consumable way.
You need to see it.
It's the
yeah.
Well, it forms the backdrop of the whole story.
Right.
You've got this huge horrific event going on, and we have Oscar Schindler kind of standing in the middle of it as it's all whirling around him.
Right.
And he's trying to either, and thinking he can, well, initially thinking he can kind of control the events, and then it suddenly realizes him, hey, this event is bigger than anything I could ever do, and I can't control, the only control I have is just this little tiny piece, and I'm going to try to hold on to it.
And see, for my money, the images of the Holocaust were more necessary for Schindler's List than the D-Day invasion was for Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, they're both equally very powerful, amazingly done. I mean, just, you know, gut-wrenching in their own ways, because they're very different, you know, thematically and style and everything.
Yeah.
And appropriately so. But
the Holocaust stuff is almost like Chinese water torture. And then the Omaha Beach scene is just like just blasting you,
just
in the
punching
face.
You in the face.
Yeah.
It really is.
And watching, sitting there, going through the agony of each sequence where they're separated, and then they're separated from their children, and then you know
that one series of sequences. It's probably within the last half an hour of the movie where the women go to Auschwitz.
Yeah,
and they're, you know, first they're separated from the men. Then they're separated from the children. Then the train just goes right on past.
Right.
And he goes to Auschwitz, and then they get stripped down, and then they're basically herded like cattle, naked through Auschwitz into the showers, and they're all standing there looking at the nozzles, just, and you know that gas is going to come out of them. I mean, and they're all fully aware of it, and then the big reveal is it's just water,
right?
And it's almost. You know, heartbreaking, because it's like they were expecting the end, and now it's just like, oh, they're going to have to live with more of this crap, and yeah, it's just going to continue until they eventually do get killed.
But that's just right. It. The way it's instructed is, after the water comes out and they're all getting wet, it's a huge relief for the audience. Oh God, you know, it didn't happen. But it doesn't hit you like you say until later. Is no, this isn't the end.
This is only the beginning.
Yeah. Beginning right. of another round of horror.
Right.
Right. And there are multiple scenes like that throughout the movie. The guy at the factory who is slowly making the hinges.
Yeah.
And ends up, you know, they end up taking him outside to shoot him, and the guns jam. He can't. They can't shoot him. That scene is just so jarring. It's like you just expect the shot to happen, even after it doesn't happen over and over and over again.
The scene where they keep shooting people until they tell who stole something or whatever, and
they line them up. Who stole it? They shot a guy. The guy falls. Who stole it? And the kid steps up.
And then it's the huge comic relief. He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like. In the matter of that horror, we see this smart-ass kid, you know.
Or, probably, in my opinion, the best scene in the whole movie, when Ammon Goethe, is it pronounced Goethe or Goethe, or I don't know how you pronounce his last name.
Goethe, I think.
Goethe. He is told by Liam Neeson, or Schindler, it's more powerful to pardon someone than to kill them. So he tries this out.
Yeah.
He's, oh, I pardon you. And then he's, I pardon you. And then she's walking away, and then he starts just shooting at her until he kills her. You know, that was really, I think, probably the most devastating scene in the whole movie, I think.
Yeah.
For me. I mean, because it was like, you know, here's Schindler
really
wasting his time trying to rationalize with these people, and it's, you know...
And it's not even all of the people. It is that guy.
Well, that, yeah, but he's...
Because he was just evil.
He's somewhat emblematic, though, of the people
that rose to the top of that. He was a caricature of what the hierarchy of the SS was. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really was. I mean, you know, there were guys like that. There probably were some that weren't quite to that extreme. But, I mean, he made a great foil for the film.
Right. Yeah, he was a great foil to Schindler. And the Schindler character is able to develop well based on this, you know, undeveloping, unmoved nut. That is his exact foil in the entire film. And they're buddies, you know, so to speak.
Right.
In a way,
right.
You know, which is really...
Well, that's the weird thing while watching Oscar Schindler just sit here and manipulate this guy by just playing to his ego, and just dancing all around him all the time,
and just
manipulating him to what he wants. Either like Schindler is the greatest salesman in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the one of the greatest con men too.
He's a con man, businessman, a shyster. I mean, he's got all these aspects about him, but.
The thing is, he understands people really well.
Right. Well, and that he wouldn't be able to be those things if he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. His confidence is just—it's just amazing. You're going up against this beast of a man, and you're just twisting and turning him all the ways you want him to go.
Yeah. All right. So let's kind of pull it back a little bit, and let's talk about some of the acting. Three major. Roles. I would say three.
I would agree.
Of course, Oscar Schindler.
Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Ralph Fiennes is the...
Ray Fiennes as...
Ammon Goethe.
As Goethe. And then,
of course, the great
Ben Kingsley as Itzhak...
is actually Stern.
Yeah,
Stern.
It's actually, yeah.
And phenomenal.
Yeah, all of them,
all around.
All of them are really great, and in some ways, none of them ever really get to do work of that caliber again. In a way, I mean, you know, after that movie, I mean, Ray Fiennes has been in some Oscar picture winners, but
right.
I don't know what happened to him after that. But I mean, you know, he never really. I mean, this was pretty much
he embraced that role.
Yeah,
he was just evil.
Yeah,
I mean, he really was. The character was just evil. And,
yeah,
and it was perfect. I mean,
but it wasn't even like a typical evil. It was kind of a like
it's the cold calculated.
Snot, you know, kind of like a snotty little kid kind of evil.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, some of the really great character moments for that for him are like the night when they're going through Poland
to the ghetto, cleaning
it out. And it's like halfway through, and there's like stuff going all around him, and he's like warming his hands. He's like, "Oh, can't this night just be over?"
Yeah,
he's
this is
bored.
A big inconvenience.
Yeah,
for me.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. He's a selfish man, to put it mildly.
Well, not only selfish, but terribly unfeeling.
Yeah,
I mean, this is more of a huge inconvenience for him because he's got to stay up late.
Right.
Right.
Out in the cold.
Now, one of the things that that's kind of funny looking back at it now, the first time I saw the movie, the first time I tried to watch the movie, it was one of those things that was like on HBO or something, and I turned it on about halfway through and watched a few minutes of it. The first time I watched it, I kept getting confused because I couldn't make a distinction between Ray Fiennes and Liam Neeson.
Oh, really?
Because I didn't know either of those actors
right.
at that point. So it wasn't like... You know,
one time he's in a suit, one time he's in a Nazi uniform.
There's Qui-Gon in there. You know, I didn't
right,
have any of
right.
that. So it's kind of funny that, you know, now it's... I can't imagine why I had that trouble. But, you know, I also really probably wasn't paying that close attention to it that time.
It's in black and white, too. And
yeah.
There's a lot of other things
you lose
going
a lot
on.
Of detail. And
I mean, it's... You know, even Liam Neeson, who... is a great actor and obviously a headlining actor in his own right, and now he kind of has carved out a unique action niche for himself in his 50s, which mm-hmm. I think is pretty interesting. Those are good movies. But he doesn't really, you know, nothing really compares to what he did in this movie. I mean, not even close.
No.
You know? I mean, he does a lot of good supporting work in the mm-hmm. movies, but it's just... The movie really is truly exceptional in a lot of ways. Spielberg gets a lot of crap, and I think I probably dish it out too, but I mean, it really is a great movie. I mean,
yeah,
you know, so Kingsley,
solid,
probably his best work since Gandhi.
Yeah, exactly.
Easily.
Yeah,
he's done some
It's pretty
bad
horrific
work.
Stuff. Yes, I know.
He's done some good stuff.
Well,
House of Sand and Fog was good.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's uneven. It's the thing is, he'll go from a really great one, then he'll go to a really horrible one. And, like, now, granted, like, there's such a contractual obligation picture, but good Lord. Good Lord, man, be a little more picky.
He's made some poor choices.
Yeah.
I mean, he's cashed some paychecks.
Yeah.
But... I mean, they all have at certain points.
Well, that just it. Sometimes if you want to work, you want to work.
Right.
Right,
right, right. And then Ray Fiennes was just, I mean, he just embraced that role.
Yeah.
I mean, he really did. He just grabbed it and ran with it.
I think it's interesting because I wouldn't say that Spielberg necessarily draws a lot out of his actors when they're in other movies of his. So I don't I don't know what it was about that particular movie. That
it could have been just the subject matter, and I know Spielberg took a. I mean, Spielberg's a Jew, so he had a very personal connection to this movie. I know he researched it. He spoke with many of the Schindler Jews.
Mm-hmm. He actually cast a few in the survivors in the movie
right.
too, and some of their kids.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. You know, one of the interesting things that in some movies it's it's overdone. For a movie like this, it's kind of, it was cool, was that last sequence when it's like a pilgrimage to Oscar Schindler's grave. And they showed, one of the cool things was, and it took me like four or five people to realize exactly what they were doing, where they would have the actor with the person that they were playing, the actual historic individual that they were playing in the film, and having them escort them up to the grave to place a stone on the grave. And I thought that was really cool. And in some movies I've seen it done, and it's like you roll your eyes and just, movie's over, click, and that every time I'm just compelled to sit through it, even though it's like 5 minutes long, nothing really happens. It's just
closure.
Yeah, I almost need it after watching the movie because it's so.
Well, it's kind of reassuring that these were actual people. They really did live this.
Yeah,
and they did survive it.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah,
you get some nice little facts too that are a little more reassuring. Just how few. I mean, you see things about just how few Jews there are in Poland, and then they through the course of the film, they say that he saved like 1,100 people or something. Over 1,000, just over 1,000, but not like 1,200. I know it's somewhere in that range. And in the end, there are 6,000, either at the time the movie was made, descendants.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. It's like those people wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him and what he did. And that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really does have an epic perspective on the entire struggle and what it means.
Well, it puts a human face on the whole thing. I mean, you read history, it's names, dates, events. But when you actually meet somebody who's actually been through it, it adds a little bit more of a personal touch to the whole thing. And again, everybody's experience would be different, but for these 1,000 people, they at least had a common root.
Yes. All right, so the movie. The movie's what, 3 hours? About 3 hours and 15 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So stepping through the plot would be a little ridiculous.
Yeah,
but there are big parts of it that can be.
I bet I can do the plot though in 2 minutes.
Oh yeah, I mean it's pretty straightforward, really.
Oscar Schindler wants to start a business. He has been a failure, I think, already at some businesses. You don't know
about
that,
everything,
but you get the context clues from. He's got this much money left in his drawer. He's got basically everything he owns in like a drawer. He puts it with him. He goes to the party and he tries to wine and dine these German officers. Mm-hmm. Then he gets support for the war contracts.
And at this point, we're in World War II. The Nazis have
rolled over Poland pretty much.
Yeah, they've rolled over Poland and they've started. Cataloging the Jews? I guess that's the best way to put it. Basically, they did a census to track all the Jewish people living there and to mark them. They gave them their Star of David.
They're consuming everything.
And
I mean, they're really rapidly just going through every possession that anyone had ever had that was a member of the Jewish population. Mm-hmm. In lands that they've conquered, and
just looting the country.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. I mean, it's been happening for thousands of years.
They needed money. I mean, they're running a war, and Hitler had, you know, had found a scapegoat, and you know, these were people that they could take from.
It also is interesting to me that when you have free labor, you will be an amazing businessman.
I mean,
which is exactly how he makes, which how Schindler makes his money.
Yeah, I mean, Schindler found a niche.
Yeah,
he found an unoccupied business.
Mm-hmm.
He had enough money, not much, but he had enough money to wine and dine enough of the Jewish, or not the Jewish, the German officers to give him an in. Then he had enough balls to go to the Jews that were losing everything and say, "Hey, look, You're not going to have anything. Money is going to be worthless to you. You are going to be slaves.
Right.
Period. But if you give me everything you've got, I'll help you out on the back end.
Right.
I'll give you items which you can sell on the black market.
Right.
Because, you know what? Money is going to be worthless to you. But trade goods are your end.
Right.
So he was savvy enough to realize that this was the way it was. And
he threw him a life. He threw him a lifeline.
He did. And you know what's funny is, in his own way, he almost seemed to rationalize what he was doing.
Complete exploitation.
I'm helping you.
Well, yeah. I'm doing well while doing good.
Right.
Well, yeah. It's an argument that was used in this country when there were slaves in America, the argument would be like, well, we provide them with these.
We took these savages. We took these savages from living in villages in Africa, and now we're giving them homes.
The blessings of liberty,
and
the blessings of civilization,
and religion, and you know, we're giving them these things. And it's like,
all we require,
and whatever helps you sleep at night, I guess.
Right. I mean, that's
all
what
it requires. You work 24/7, 365.
Yeah,
with no vacation.
That's
and no pay.
What they're doing in the movie, and Schindler, you know, obviously, he can make money. I mean, his labor costs are very low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got big government contracts.
Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty much a no-brainer. But then from there, you know, things take a critically wrong step when Goethe and him get to know each other, and he thinks, "Oh, I'm really going to live high on the hog with this guy." And Goethe is a complete nut who destroys people. I mean, absolutely destroys people. And he just can't take it anymore. And he starts in small ways trying to help out the people who are being oppressed. And then in other ways, he starts to take on a more substantive role in trying to control Goethe's ambitions and how to run things. And that's pretty much the story.
What's great is that they tell you right up front that, I mean, you see that he's taking advantage of a terrible situation to make money. So he's war profiteering, which is in its own way bad.
Not only
on
is
that
he war
level.
Profiteering though,
but
he's
then
also
but you know he's also
exploiting an entire, you know, people for labor.
Well,
I mean,
he's doing that.
Two different things in
a way.
But
then also, not only that, but like his personal life is just is in tatters.
Well, he's a womanizer and a drinker. And
the best character moment for him and womanizing is when he goes to his wife and is like, "We're set, everything's great, you know, we're going to be set." And she's like, "Okay, so I don't ever want the maitre d' to assume that I'm anyone other than Mrs. Oscar Schindler." The next thing you see is her on a train out of town. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just shows you just how messed up this dude was.
Yeah.
It's like no consideration for anyone but himself.
It's
really
true.
I mean, he is as selfish as anyone at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Though he still tries to, I think in his own way, he's trying to justify all of that. In his own way, by sending her away, she's not seeing what I'm doing.
Well, yeah.
You know?
I mean, there's some of that there.
I'm still doing this, but she's not seeing it, so I'm sparing her that.
And I always remember it as being more of a mutual thing. Like she's like, all right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not really going to stick around.
She knew he was doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no question. She would never opposed it to him that way. Had
right.
she not been fully aware of what was going on.
Right.
He gets Itzhak Stern to be his manager.
Well, yeah, he's the administrator.
The administrator, yeah.
He's a guy who keeps everything running on his end.
Basically, Schindler was lazy on top of all this.
Right.
He was an idea man.
Yeah, he's the idea man.
And
I'm the CEO. I hire everybody else to run the place.
You're
the big
right.
idea man.
Yeah.
I'm the idea man. You work. That's fine. You know your people. I mean, he was a shyster from top down and played it very well. I mean, the script was perfectly written for that.
Yeah,
and
I don't
he
know
played
who wrote
it
the
great.
Script.
script was written by actually
Steven something or another.
Screenplay based by Steven Zarlian. It's based on the novel Schindler's Ark by Thomas Kinelli.
Okay.
Yeah, and he wrote something else too.
And the screenplay went through several iterations before it was. Spielberg was happy with it. It took about 10 years for him to get a decent script written.
Yeah,
because the book came out in 1983, and Spielberg told the author. Well, the author had come out with the book in around 1983 or so. And he went to Spielberg. And Spielberg really liked it, and he secured the rights, but he told him it would take him 10 years to make this movie. Wow. Because he wasn't ready for it. And it took him several iterations with different screenwriters to get something he liked. One guy came out too long, another came out too short, and didn't like the subject.
I can't imagine a longer movie.
Good Lord. I could, actually.
Well, I'm sure, yeah, but it didn't... At 3:15, that was long enough.
It's not the longest movie I've ever seen. It's been interesting, though.
But for the subject matter,
you can only sustain horror for a certain period of time before you burn out.
I don't know if I could have taken much more.
But I think that may have been the idea. I mean, the whole thing is tiring for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
That may be an intentional, is to constantly build up, drop, until you get to the end and says, oh, my God, I just can't take this anymore. I'm going to just roll over and die.
Yeah. I mean, and even the way the story's framed, when you get to the end of it,
you're emotionally drained.
Well, and the way the story actually turns. So I'll get to that in a minute. You get to a point where things have really started to go downhill fast for the Jews in Poland and in Germany. They've decided that they're going to package them all up, send them to Auschwitz. It's time to purge. I mean, basically, for lack of a better word, they're just going to clean house. They're just going to just ship them all off, and that's it. And Schindler manages to throw around some... At this point, he's got just piles of money. I mean, they show him literally with suitcases full of money. And he manages to start throwing some bribes around and convinces the hierarchy that, hey... I need a workforce. These are government contracts. If you want these items, these munitions that I'm contracted to make for you, I need a workforce.
Right.
And
they've already got them trained.
Yeah, they're already trained. These people know the business. They know the factory. These are my people. I know that they can do the job. And so he convinces them to let him keep some of the people. And this is where the Schindler's List aspect comes from.
Right.
Where he's actually saving these groups of people from annihilation.
And there are several moments where he thinks to himself, this has gone so far out now. Like, especially when he's walking to his car and it looks like black snow.
Right.
And then he realizes it's ashes of the people they're burning.
Yeah. That wasn't even like from Auschwitz. That was, they were digging up the mass graves.
Right.
To burn the evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how horrifying it got.
It's, yeah.
Well, that's when it hits him that this is no longer just, this is the true horror that's starting to hit. I've been standing apart from it, and now it's literally raining down on me.
Well, and you have to kind of imagine that Schindler was a savvy enough businessman and could read people well enough and read situations well enough that he got himself in that situation in the first place. But it's almost as if he had an insight that this house of cards is crumbling.
Yeah.
Things are falling down around me. And everything I've got is pretty much worthless. So he started to carve out that niche for himself, that just hoping he could hold off long enough that...
Pull one last scam.
Yeah. And his game was, if he can hold off long enough for the war to end, then maybe he can walk away with
something.
You know, be it money, be it...
His neck?
Know, his soul? You know, yeah, his neck, because the rate he was going, if the war would have lasted much longer, he was dead. I mean, they would have just finished him.
Well, they would have finished him because he would have run out of money and he would have run out of bribes and then wouldn't be able to influence anybody.
Yeah.
The only reason he was holding any of this together was because he was pouring gobs of cash literally down their throats to keep them off his back.
That, and one of the best things, one of the scenes that I very clearly remember from the first time I saw the movie was when Stern comes to him and says, "Hey, we're getting a lot of complaints that the shells aren't passing inspection. This is a problem because if we don't pass, then they're gonna ship us off because we're not doing good work. They're gonna wrap us up and send us to Auschwitz. We need to fix this. The rumors are that you're miscalibrating the equipment." And he's like, "Find out where we can buy more shells." If this
mix
factory,
enough good ones in there.
Now I can't remember, why did he miscalibrate the equipment?
Well, he said it right then. He said, "I will be very disappointed if this factory ever turns out any munitions that will work successfully. Basically, look, you're making. We're not going to further this war anymore.
Further the war anymore. Yeah.
We're going.
At that point, it becomes an ideal. Yeah.
At this point, he's sabotaging the war.
Yeah.
Because he's furthering his own ends. He's come to the realization, and that's the clearest indication. The war is going to end, and if I can prove to the good guys that I was a good guy.
Right.
When this all shakes out, maybe I'll survive after the war. When the Allied forces and the Soviets come in, he knows that they're going to check.
Yep.
You know, who aided the Nazis? Who aided the war effort?
They're going to find the collaborators were.
Yeah, and he would totally be a collaborator. He was, you know, he was
profited from it. He ran it, and he instigated it.
Yes. Yeah.
And he profited from it.
And his actions in that last year probably saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably saved him from a war tribunal. I mean, at the very least. But he was actually able to walk out fairly scot-free, considering he was complicit in a lot of bad shit.
Yeah.
I mean, he really was. But he was still able to walk out of it pretty scot-free.
Well, at least with his life.
Yeah.
Which is more than many of the others
ended
up with. And I guess, in a way, that's a victory in itself.
Yeah. And so, you know, as things wrap up, he's throwing his money hand over fist to bribe officials, you know, at the review board who are reviewing the munitions that come out. He's bribing people to keep his staff there. The guards that show up to guard the factory, he dresses them down in front of their commanding officer. At a great speech about, look, these people are considered property for the war effort. If you kill one of them, you will be penalized, and I will get money because you have taken away my ability to profit from this, and you're hurting the war effort. So, no soldiers in the factory unless I say so. By the way, here's some cases of beer.
Right.
I mean, he knew how to speak to people and get people to do what he wanted.
Well, it's true. I mean, in other ways, though, I mean, he bribed people. I mean,
yeah, he played.
Who at that point was going to be an idealist about that war, except the inner circle of Hitler?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that was totally, you know, doable.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah, these guys were, you're also talking about soldiers who were babysitting, for lack of a better word. They were hanging out, babysitting a factory.
Yep.
And I mean, in the way they thought, a factory full of subhumans.
Yeah.
Because they, I mean, they really did just think of the Jewish people as less than human.
Yeah.
And that was another thing that really was really emphasized throughout the movie.
Right. They did a lot of cultural touches. Even when a little kid is stoning the Jewish people as they're in line,
mm-hmm.
walking away. I can't remember when, where. It was pretty early in the movie. And then when he goes to jail for kissing a Jewish woman,
right.
Oscar Schindler.
At his birthday party.
Yeah. And when he gets to jail, he says, the guy says, "What are you in here for?" He says, "I kissed a Jewish woman." And he goes, "Oh, yeah? Did your thing fall off?" You know?
And yeah.
It was, you know, he kind of just turns his back and looks at the cell and doesn't say anything, you know. But it's pretty clear.
And I actually liked how Goethe stuck up for him at that point.
Yeah.
He's like, "Oh, they've got this thing about them."
Well,
it's like a
isn't
disease.
He in love with? Isn't he in love with one of? Yeah, he's in love with like his housekeeper. Or
right.
Like yeah.
It's a disease. I've seen my men have it. It's
yeah.
They have this mystique about them. It's their magic. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, Goethe was an interesting character because not only was he remarkably evil and selfish, but he also was in some
was
really weird ways.
He was terribly hypocritic.
And in some ways, a charming character in those situations.
Yeah.
You know, because you'd be like, oh, like, he's just a party guy like me. We just, you know, we lost control and...
He was his drinking buddy.
Yeah.
I mean, he really was.
It was really, it's a bizarre, complex relationship between two messed up characters, which is really interesting. I mean,
that's the best way to put it.
Maybe I want to talk about too the cinematography that Spielberg used. It was a big departure from what he normally did.
Oh yeah.
I mean, reading some of the liner notes on this is they used absolutely no cranes. It was all handheld cameras, no fancy Steadicams, anything. It was just all back to basics, film school. Black and white, which is a big artistic change.
Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't shot in black and white.
Yes, it was. It was shot in black and white, which made some interesting problems for the set dressing and lighting because all the crew was used, you know, to doing color.
Right.
And black and white is sort of a lost art.
Did they add the color then?
No, they did not add any color. I mean, well, some of there were...
There are a couple scenes
there's
where
a couple
there
scenes
is
that
color.
Are... Is
where
it,
yeah, where they... Yeah, right. They have this scene where the girl in the red coat
right.
is at. That was a special effect that was added later.
Okay.
But the whole film was done in black and white.
Okay.
And that makes sense.
But they had some of it was... They had to add a color effect
there's
to
no,
make it a little more
the girl
yellow.
In the red coat was one of the big turning points for mm-hmm. Schindler's character, too.
Right.
Because he had seen the girl, he had seen a young girl in a red coat playing and in the streets. And at another point, we actually see the girl hide under a bed.
Mm-hmm.
And the point where he finds the ashes on his car, and he kind of goes out to meet with Goethe and find out what's going on. And a cart goes by with bodies, and he sees the red coat. He sees you can't make out much because of the black and white and because it's massive bodies, but you can very clearly see the red coat in the cart full of dead bodies, and it was the look on his face was just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
This was a little girl.
This is real.
And this isn't new. This happened a while ago.
Right.
And I knew about this.
Right.
And so it you could really kind of see it sink in. I mean, he had cracks in it before, but that's where it like really punched him in the gut.
And you said something about the yellowing?
Right, there was a yellow sepia effect, which they added in certain scenes to give it a little bit more of a documentary-style look from that period. Like, the film is a little aged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a cool idea. I never even noticed it.
Yeah, if you watch through it, you'll see it in there in places.
It's a sepia. Mm-hmm.
And they really did touch on a lot of the cultural aspects of Germany at the time. You know, we're all aware of, you know, the Jewish people were living in the ghettos when they weren't living in concentration camps. But but just the lifestyle that the Germans were living.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to fancy parties and you know, eating well, dressing well, living the high life. Especially the commanding hierarchy of the SS
class. The officer class, they were living like kings.
Like right. Aristocracy.
Yeah. But I mean, that was pretty much the whole idea of fascism. I mean, you know, that's why Mussolini had the Fasces, you know, which ended up becoming the term fascism. Fasces were those Roman, like, long grain, the symbols.
Right.
Well, the symbol of Rome.
The Caesarean, symbol for the rulership.
Sticks. Right, the staves tied together.
Yes.
Indicating the unity of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the most interesting part of having Oscar Schindler be the main character, because you can realistically see all the different parts of the classes that were going on, because he very definitely would have attended parties like that.
Right.
But he would have also been aware of, and he would have had communication with, like, Stern, you know, because of his factories and the people that would come to him and try to thank him. One of the interesting things that happened early on is when Stern says, you know, I, there's a factory worker that wants to thank you. You know, he just wants to come up and thank you personally. Is that okay? And he says, okay, fine, whatever. The guy comes in and he only has one arm.
Yeah.
And it almost is at that point as he's realized that, you know, he's the shyster, and Stern's pulled a fast one on him.
Right. He says, "Why? What use is this person? This is dangerous to me."
Right.
And he says, "No, this is great." And then he's like, "Success!" When he's like leaving, he's like holding his arms up in the air, trying to speak Schindler's language at the time,
right,
at the beginning of the movie, which is pretty good. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I mean,
he conned a con man.
Yeah,
he really did, and he showed him that, hey, everybody's getting something out of this. You know, you're getting something out of it. Well, I'm going to take my piece too, and my piece isn't money. It's the people that I know. It's my people.
Right.
I'm going to save as many of my people as I can.
Right.
And then Schindler ends up turning that around later when they're hauling the kids away. And the German guards are, like, hauling the kids away. And he's like, what are you doing? These are valuable, skilled workers. And the guard's like, what?
He says, no one else can reach in and
no one else can polish the shell.
Polish
the inside of the shells. Can you do this? Do you see these hands? They can polish the inside of the shells. No one else can do that. Do you know somebody else that can do that? These are skilled workers.
Yeah.
And the guard's like, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
If you say so.
Yeah. No, it was very, I mean, those moments are pretty satisfying, I think.
Yeah, and you can see how Stern taught him.
How to think like that.
Yeah, to spin those situations and say, you know, these are people. You know, they're not, you know, these subhumans that the Germans are trying to tell you that they are. They're not, you know, your junk isn't going to fall off if you kiss a Jewish girl, you know?
Right.
That's not going to happen. They're just people. And they're valuable because they are people. I remember what it was I was thinking of earlier. Apparently, women wake up topless all the time.
In that movie, they do.
It's like the big go-to scene transition was a woman waking up topless. It happened like at least three times that I counted. It was just...
Well, it happens with Schindler and Goethe and Schindler
again. Schindler again, yeah.
I think it was more to the effect of what kind of lifestyle those guys were living.
Yeah.
Was really kind of the point of that, you know?
And one of the things that, and it just to show you, and just to show you how jaded everyone was, when the one that's with Goethe wakes up, and she wakes up the gunshots, and she's like, ugh, like, again?
Yeah.
And they show Goethe, and he's just sitting off of his bedroom with no shirt on, just in his pants, shooting
at people.
At people,
yeah.
Just because,
why not? It's a nice day.
Target practice.
Yeah.
I mean, the dude was messed up, but as messed up as he was, she's more annoyed because she's awakened by his shooting.
Yep.
I mean,
please, just, dear, not right now.
Yeah. Not before my coffee.
Not before coffee, yes. I got a hangover.
Yeah.
It's become such a commonplace thing. Yeah. It's just annoying now. It used to be horrifying. Now it's just an everyday occurrence.
Yeah. I just think that this movie was crafted so much better than most of Spielberg's work. I mean, there was just so much more thought and consideration.
Well, that's why it was such a surprise. I mean, when it came out, it's like, this is Steven Spielberg? I mean, this is the guy who makes all the schmaltzy family pictures,
action adventures,
and then suddenly, boom, he drops this huge rock in the water.
He did make, and it bombed at the box office, and it was probably scared him away from doing a picture like that for 6 years, but he did make a very good war drama called Empire of the Sun.
Yes,
Christian Bale.
Right. And that is another very, very well done war drama for him. I mean, the problems I have with Saving Private Ryan and Munich, as I think they're good movies, but they kind of operate on some very flimsy character ground, and they also hit you over the head with what they're trying to do.
Right.
Schindler's List and Empire of the Sun, you know, are really more artistic, more like finer achievements in terms of film. I mean,
yeah, but the only problem with Empire of the Sun is it was just way too artsy fartsy too soon.
It was probably for people's perception of him yeah,
at that
but
time.
I mean,
it was a huge departure. You were going there expecting an action adventure film, and you end up with something that is a character drama, a rather drawn out one. It's the biggest problem with Empire of the Sun, it's just too damn long.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too long, but I do see why it would be perceived as too weird for him.
Right.
But what's interesting to me is no one says that 6 years later, because then he's got the marketing behind him. You know, he's kind of honed
his filmmaking skills.
It's coming out. It's going to be this big deal, and he didn't hit people from left field with it. But I think it was always there. Because Empire of the Sun proved that he could do that.
Yeah.
He just...
Well, for Empire of the Sun...
Just the time wasn't right.
Yeah.
For Empire of the Sun, I'm going to play the Adam card, because I have not seen it.
Oh, okay. Great movie.
It sounds like it. I'm curious to see it now because of the a young Christian Bale.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very animated Christian Bale.
He's great in it. And when I saw The Machinist... Because I actually knew Christian Bale from that movie when I was very young. When I saw The Machinist, God, he looked like he was 10 years old because he'd lost, like, all the rest of his body weight.
That movie.
And he just...
He looks terrifying.
Oh, my gosh. And you can almost see his face when he was a kid in that movie because he's so gaunt. And
well,
so...
If you think that's fun, go see The Fighter.
I loved him in that. Yeah, it was great. He didn't lose as much as he lost with The Machinist. He looked like a friggin'... bat, you know.
Yeah, it was. He was terrifying.
It
was The Machinist,
but you could.
It was uncomfortable to watch. I mean,
it was uncomfortable to watch.
Just how gaunt and skeletal he was. Because I mean, that's really the.
And he really did it. I mean, there was no effect.
There was no effects involved, and that's the worst part. What's funny is knowing that he went immediately to doing Batman Begins, and. And if you know that and you watch Batman Begins, he bulked up quick.
Like, too much.
Yeah, and there's scenes, especially it's when he comes back to Gotham, like he's been away at college, and he comes back to Gotham, and he's like, I'm going to be a badass street fighter. There's a handful of scenes for about 10 minutes. He looks puffy.
Yeah.
He really does. He's like, dude. You need to slim down a little bit. You need to lay off the cheeseburgers.
Well, you see
Batman.
where he's doing the ninjutsu training, man. He looks like, that worked for that scene, but it was just like, oh my gosh, and it was, It was probably really unhealthy. I don't know how he did that. And
he said, I remember reading something at the time, and he's like carved up, just like tons of pizza and pastas and
cheese. Whoa.
Just, yeah.
Cheeseburgers.
Yeah.
Potato chips.
He just, pastas. It was carbs and fats.
Whoa.
Just to put.
And not burning them off.
Since we're on the subject of him, I'm just glad he won the Academy Award. He deserved it. Finally, someone who got nominated for an acting award deserved it for the role they were in.
Mm-hmm.
And he also deserved it for a lot of other things he didn't even get nominated for. So I'm just really glad that he won, because he's a great actor.
And I loved his acceptance speech.
Yeah.
I really did. He's like, I have no business being here.
It was awesome.
If winning this means I get to work with the rest of the people I'm nominated with, that's awesome. That is a great speech.
It was a great speech, and he even pointed out the real character, the real man who he played, and had him stand up and promoted his boxing training.
I loved
and
all how
that was great.
I loved how everybody booed him when he did that. Did you catch that?
It was so dumb.
He said, he's like, oh, and he's the man. Go to, and I don't remember the name of the website.
DickEklund.com. Yeah.
All right. So boo for you for doing.
Yeah.
No, he did that, and they booed. And what's funny is, it's like, so then they go to a commercial break, they come back from the commercial break, and it's on ABC. And it's like 2 minutes of ABC just jerking off all over everything. We just got a 10-year contract. Whoa!
Yeah.
You know, and they're just like, check out how great we are, ABC, hoo-ah, you know? And
so dumb.
And it's like, you're letting this slide and you're clapping for this, but you're booing. You know,
well, there's a huge difference. They're rich actors, and Dick Eklund is just a working class stiff.
Just a dude.
Screw him.
Exactly.
You know? I mean,
That annoyed.
I have plenty of problems with the aristocracy of the Oscars, but
yeah.
But I'm glad he won.
Oh yeah,
he deserved to win. You know,
I'm with you there.
You know, and but anyway, I know that's not.
Speaking of Oscars, though, I'm gonna go ahead and jump in.
Okay.
I watched The Hurt Locker not too long ago.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
I want to know who she did what to and what she did for how long. That movie did not deserve the accolades it got in the Oscar community.
Well, I think...
It did not.
Basically,
I think it was all political.
I have not seen it, and I think probably knowing the kind of movies I like, when I see it, I will like it, because I kind of know what I
like. It's a good movie. Don't get me wrong. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie, and I got the point of it.
Well,
did not deserve the Oscar.
The Oscars have been dying to reward a movie about the Iraq War that actually was an incredibly good movie, which, let's face it, all the movies that have been coming out about the Iraq War are no damn good. They just suck.
That's all there is
to it. And so here they have a chance to reward a movie for speaking about the war.
With a female director who's Cameron's ex. Because
well,
they really wanted to put a thumb in Cameron's eye over Avatar.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that all that undercurrent was in play. I didn't know about that.
Yeah,
she was directly against her ex-husband in that year? I did not know that little storyline.
Yeah. She was directly against her ex, and he had Avatar. You know, and that was Avatar. It would have been Avatar's year.
I don't know if it would have been Avatar's year.
Avatar had no business winning. Don't get me wrong there. I am not saying
that. Well, also because he won for... he did that whole thing, broke all box office records, created a special effects epic, and won everything.
Then the next...
10 years ago,
then the next
move
he makes does the same thing.
The exact same thing. Oh, yeah. He's...
Yeah.
I would say he's once in a 10-year...
I think he's proved his point. You know?
Hey, man, he's probably more successful. I mean, Spielberg's more prolific. But when you look at
50
per
movies?
Film, what a man has achieved per film in terms of special effects,
well,
critical success.
The state of the art,
yeah, I mean, I don't think Cameron has an equal with respect to the sheer numbers of that.
And not only that, but the mainstream of acceptance... Of what he's done.
At every level.
That the mainstream accepted and embraced Avatar the way it did is astounding. I mean, I was shocked. Because I was like, oh, this is going to be novel.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to do okay. I'm sure it might make its money back. You know? And then it just kind of blew everything out of the water.
Well, it's just like with the Titanic. When he came out with the Titanic and they were talking about how it was overrunning on budget and how it was going to be this big failure, and it had a hook.
Yeah.
People loved. I mean, it was a love story. You know, it was that simple. You just like Avatar, it wasn't really... I mean, the 3D was neat, but it wasn't really about the 3D.
No.
People liked the story.
The story. It was compelling to people.
You know, so...
But not the geeks. The ones who wanted to...
Well,
to
it was a mainstream film.
It was a mainstream movie. It was not... It was not.
And you look like you're probably going to say something, but I keep cutting you off.
Avatar just, like I say, it pushed so many boundaries. Yes, maybe the geek community didn't fall in love with it immediately. Maybe they'll grow with them in time. But
I, being a geek, I enjoyed it a hell of a lot.
I mean, it's granted, the story is derivative in many places if you sit back and think about it for a while. But hey, no, what movie isn't?
Right.
I mean, it's hard to, if 100 years of film, you're gonna do a little. A little overlapping here and there. People tended to beat up on it because they said, oh, it was Dancing with Wolves. No jackasses. No, it was Little Big Man.
Yeah.
Go back another 20 years. Dustin Hoffman did the same story.
Yeah.
Get your genres right.
Well, you know, people always want to hate something that gets a critical mass of acceptance because then
they
want to
hate something that's only within their current memories. They never want to do their history homework and look at the films that preceded it.
Right. No, I completely agree. I mean,
I heard something recently that Matt Damon was going to be cast in the main role that I can't remember the guy's name now was in for Avatar, and it's like,
I don't know.
Wow, that would have been a completely different experience.
Probably.
Because he is so much a better actor than that guy was. I mean, he wasn't terrible, but, I mean, just on a... Damon's just on a completely different level than that guy was. I also don't know how it would have worked. I mean, kind of liked the fact that he was kind of an unknown. So,
you know, that was something that worked in Jurassic Park, too.
Yeah.
Was, you know, with the big special effects pictures, you don't always want somebody that's going to be really well known. Because
you don't want to distract.
Yeah.
Star Wars works so well because who knew any of those people?
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, yeah, Sir Alec Guinness, even Harrison Ford had done a little bit of work.
But Harrison Ford had only done one other movie before this. That was American Graffiti.
Right, right.
Force 10 from Navarone, dog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought that was done after...
I think it was before, actually.
No, after.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was before.
No, it was after.
Was
because he did Blade Runner after Star Wars, and then he did Force 10 from Navarone.
No, Blade Runner is like not till 82. I think Force 10 is like 70s, way back when.
All right, you're gonna make me look this
up. We're gonna get into the IMDb of it.
Well, one other thing too, another, going back to our Schindler's List is, you'd probably appreciate this. Originally, Spielberg was not going to direct this film.
Let me guess, Kubrick was.
No.
Oh.
Roman Polanski.
Oh, well then he did.
But
the
Polanski, wow. He did The Pianist. He did his own, and then guess who else was on the A-list for director?
Scorsese?
Martin Scorsese.
Wow. But I cannot imagine what...
Yes,
you
can imagine only how different this movie would have been if he had directed it.
I don't think anyone would have gone to see it.
It surely would have been... since Spielberg offered him the chance to direct, but he turned it down and went to Cape Fear instead.
Yeah. Wow.
And
I
Billy
can't even
Wilder,
imagine how much different... That would be...
Well, I know Spielberg was the one who executive produced Cape Fear, because he said to Scorsese, we're going to make a movie of yours that's going to make money. And that's exactly what they said. That was the conversation
that's
they had.
That's hilarious.
Spielberg's like, you've never made any money on any of your movies, we're going to make a movie that makes money.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did,
wow.
Cape Fear. Yeah. And I guess after that, Spielberg offered him, I guess, Schindler's List, and... I just can't imagine. I mean, because if you already know it's a Scorsese movie and it's about the Holocaust, I mean, what are you going to expect to see? I mean, it's going to be... I mean, he kind of, like, does wallow a bit in the... It would be more in the process, I think, than in the, you know...
Billy Wilder and Sidney Pollack were also running too.
Interesting.
Yes, very interesting. It always interests speculation if Spielberg had just stayed in the producer role and let somebody else do the work. How much different this movie would have been.
It would have been neat to have Scorsese do it.
Harrison Ford was in The Great Escape.
Was he?
Young Nazi on the train.
Wow.
But Spielberg decided to do it himself.
I just can't. What do you think it would be like, Scorsese directing Schindler's List?
I can't even imagine.
I can't either.
Well, Schindler would be a very different person.
Would he be Travis Bickle, basically, doing business?
Would
he be the taxi driver?
Ray Liotta in Goodfellas? I mean, just be like, he'd be a much less sympathetic character. I mean,
oh yeah.
I mean, Schindler would be a cold, cold bastard in a Scorsese movie.
He'd wake up in the morning talking to himself. I drive the streets at night.
All the Jews would have Brooklyn accents, and all the Nazis would have.
Joe Pesci could be Goethe.
The Nazis would be from Arkansas.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh. It'd be that messed up.
Wow.
That would be crazy.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Yes, Schindler would get up.
He got to do a little bit of Holocaust work in Shutter Island. Mm-hmm. I mean, he got to do a little bit of the World War II stuff. Scorsese never really gravitated towards that kind of work, really, ever. I mean, I don't think he's done a single war movie. Shutter Island is the flashbacks.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever done a war movie of any kind, if I think about it.
Maybe just not his bag, so.
Probably not.
Or no one's ever offered him to do one.
Well, Willem Dafoe said. He says, I can't confirm this, but Scorsese's not one who likes to be outdoors very much. He's like, we did Last Temptation of Christ and
that was
wherever it was, and he was like, I love being out in the desert, and Scorsese just didn't want to be out there, he thought.
So. Did you hear that they're actually bringing back Taxi Driver to the theaters?
That would be awesome.
Later in March. But it's only going to be like in 40 cities, and St. Louis is not one of them.
I thought hopefully the Tivoli would grab that.
No, it's like AMC is doing it, and the closest, I think, is Kansas City.
Kansas City?
Yeah. Road trip.
Maybe. I might do that for Taxi Driver. It'd be fantastic.
Why does Kansas City always get picked?
I mean, I don't know.
We're a bigger film town than they are.
It's a. It'll be 35 years this year.
It's the 35th anniversary. Yeah, 35th anniversary. That's what they're doing it for. Basically, based on the success of some of the other movies that have been re-released to theaters in these limited runs and have been successful doing it.
I would love to see it in a theater. I've never seen it on a big screen. I mean, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
I would like to do that. I don't know if I can.
March 19th and 22nd.
Really?
The 19th is a Saturday.
I wonder if I could pull that off. It would be worth it, man. It would be worth it.
Kansas City, is your wife into the Royals? Because they've got that big Princess Diana exhibit.
Oh, really?
Hounding me about.
Ironically, Karen is interested in the wedding coming up.
Well, there you go.
Interesting. Yeah, apparently it's only 2 months away, the royal wedding.
I don't pay any attention, to be honest.
Well, I was told that today, incidentally.
Well, there you go.
I said, well, if we're not invited, we're not sending a gift. That's all there is to it.
Yep.
All right.
That A-list is hard to get onto.
Have to see if Sir Elton John's doing something else. He can give us the tickets.
I don't have anything else to say about...
I think we pretty much covered all the bases on Schindler's List.
And a lot more.
Yeah.
And then some. Do with Schindler's List.
I think it's definitely a movie worth watching, but it is not an easy watch. There's a lot of history behind the story that's being told.
And a lot of drama and a lot of good character and some really innovative cinematography.
What I like about it is it's not about the Holocaust.
It's not driven by the story where we're going to show you all this stuff about the Holocaust. That's not what drives the story. It's definitely a character-centered story.
Yes.
It deserves to exist as a movie apart from...
the history.
Yes. Yeah.
You could make... you could do a cut of the film that would probably be 2 hours long that would be a compelling drama.
Mm-hmm.
That cuts out a lot of the Holocaust stuff. Because, quite frankly, there are scenes in the movie that Oskar Schindler would not have firsthand knowledge about. If this is primarily the story told of Oskar Schindler, there are huge chunks of the movie that can be cut out that are for effect and to inform the situation that everyone around him was living in, not necessarily what he was going through and what he had direct knowledge of. He had tangential knowledge of it because, I mean, he was a smart guy. He understood what was going on, but
if the movie were made in 1946 and you couldn't show all that stuff, you could cut the film down to a 2-hour version that would still be very compelling.
Easily.
With the characters communicating about all the subject matter that everybody knows about, but not showing all of the stuff that
is just exculpatory.
Yeah. So
yeah, but I think for the work as a whole, it doesn't drag by having that. It is a compelling movie, even at 3 hours and 15 minutes long.
Well, I would also put in there one reason why Spielberg made this movie is a response to all Holocaust deniers out there.
True.
So all of that information he put in there is to put it out in front of you so you say this could not have happened.
Well, would you, I mean, at the time it was made, was there a larger amount of Holocaust deniers?
Yes, really? There was. There was a very large growing movement of it, especially in Eastern Europe, that was trying to deny a lot of this stuff happened. Even though they got all the concentration camps still sitting there rusting away, they all want to put that part of their past away.
Right.
And walk away from it.
We choose to refer to that as the moronic times.
The moronic times.
Yeah, it wasn't us. It was those bad people.
They want you to believe that because...
It makes us look bad.
Because they're dirty Jews. I mean, it was an anti-Semitic...
argument. Not for the reason there was no Holocaust?
Yeah.
That's a little...
Yeah, I mean,
it was exaggerated.
Well, yeah, it was almost, I mean, if it wasn't so terrible, it was almost comical that they were...
I mean, but how strong really was that voice?
Strong.
It was pretty
really?
Strong.
Yes.
And this was Spielberg's... It was part of the neo-Nazi movement. I mean, especially, and what you have to look at is the neo-Nazi movement was a whole lot stronger in Germany than it was around here.
Are we talking
in the United States?
In the 90s? In the 80s?
Yes.
80s and 90s, yeah.
Oh.
Yes. It's like the birthers of the past.
Not like the 60s and 70s.
No.
This is the children of that time.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that from my college days, the skinhead neo-Nazi and the spill-off of that is what informs movies like American History X.
Right.
You know, and so that was, you know, those characters were kind of the United States fallout from the stuff that was happening in Europe at the time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And there is still, again, a mass movement in parts of Eastern Europe and Western Europe to... these little core of people who just keep this little crazy idea going.
They keep
fires
burning.
I just thought that the neo-Nazi thing, for what I had seen of it, and I didn't really have a sophisticated understanding of it, was more related to like punk goth music and rebellion, and almost just nihilistic.
That's the periphery of it.
That's okay.
The real lifestylers are the hardcore.
That's the mainstream spin on it.
Okay.
I mean there is very definitely a subgroup of that group that believe and that follow it.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, I remember watching a a special documentary thing on the groups of neo-Nazis in the U.S. And you know, it was singing punk rock versions of "These Boots Are Made for Walking," and they changed the lyrics to "These Boots Are Made for Stomping," and it was the rest of the lyric was changed to basically be, you know, anti-black, anti-Semitic,
wow,
anti-everything other.
So it isn't a superficial embrace just for the sake of being rebellious. It's
for shock value. Yes.
Yeah, at the core level, these people are believers.
There's a group of people that are capitalizing on it,
right?
Because they
for marketing purposes or whatever. Yeah,
as crazy as that is. But then there's people somebody's consuming. You know, there is a market that they are tapping into of people that they want this and they believe in it.
Were the two guys that killed all those people in Columbine, were they part of that group?
I don't believe so.
They were on the periphery side of it.
They wore the black trench coats and stuff, but they weren't into
that. That was
more
for shock value.
Okay.
I mean,
even that's not what we're talking about.
These guys were a different type of hate.
Okay. No, these were, I mean, In the 80s, especially in the late 80s when I was in high school and stuff, you didn't shave your head.
Right.
That was not a fashion statement.
Okay.
That was a
political statement.
Yeah.
That's an in-your-face statement.
And it was in-your-face.
And I'll break your face.
I mean, it was like, you don't mess with the skinheads. I mean, it was like, that was just...
They're nuts.
Huh.
You didn't do that.
Wow. Okay.
Well. It's... History lesson for you, young
That's
one.
Crazy, man. I've just never heard of it as being so serious.
The good old days weren't always good.
No, but just the seriousness of it.
Yeah.
You know, I never really took the idea of a neo-Nazi that seriously. I thought it was more of
And they took themselves very seriously.
That's the problem, is everybody thinks of them as a joke, but they're not. They're not funny at all.
They're disenfranchised youth that are, you know, they have a cause and they don't have a whole lot of brains, and they're willing to, you know, smash whatever they can into your face if you disagree with them.
Yeah.
And
wow.
Yeah.
As you mentioned,
good times.
Yeah, no kidding.
but it was Spielberg's, you know,
response to all that.
Yeah, finger to them, basically. Screw you guys. This happened,
and
I'm
going to
show you just how awful it was.
Well, good for him.
Yeah,
I had no idea that undercurrent was in the movie.
There was also a little side current. They mentioned some of the liner notes there, as some of the German extras later came up to Spielberg and said thanked him for kind of getting some of the dirty secrets out there where they could be talked about rather than kind of like bottled up.
Mm-hmm.
And but surprisingly, this movie did really well in Germany.
Oh, yeah. Really?
It was sort of a catharsis for that audience to see, okay, this is really what happened.
Well,
now we
it was
can get
an
this
acceptance.
Out. Yeah, we
that
can
makes
get this
a lot of
out.
Sense.
We can get this out of the closet now and talk about it.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean,
it was very much like the Indian slaughtering movies, mm-hmm. that the white guilt movies that, you know, were.
Well, what's interesting about that is those movies were made when all of the people who did it were dead.
Yeah.
Whereas Schindler's List, the timeline's only 50 years. So it's
it's still fairly recent. I mean,
it's almost more powerful that they came to terms with it early, because, you know, like in the 1920s and 30s, no one was making movies about, you know, how we hurt the American Indians. It was all Lone Ranger cowboy stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know. So, but you know, I think maybe a lot of those movies were in response to the Wounded Knee stuff, or maybe. The Wounded Knee stuff was a result of that. I don't know. But Marlon Brando was heavily involved in that stuff.
And, right.
So that was current, but it wasn't at the time of the actual... Well, I guess it's at the time of the continuing
In the 70s,
treatment.
Yes, but you're still within the recent cultural memory.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But you had to get... Sometimes you had to put enough historical distance to start looking back on that stuff.
Yeah.
With the right critical eye.
Yeah.
And some of this stuff has to bubble up to the surface. I mean, as people get older, they can now release their memoirs, or they can reflect upon it some, or the history suddenly gets found and brought to the surface.
I mean, I just watched the Marlon Brando non-acceptance speech from The Godfather, where he sent the lady from that tribe in full ceremonial dress, and they booed her, just like the Christian Bale thing, except this was actually more serious, because it was like, well, you got like, they would never boo her now. I mean, well, there's no way. Oh, no.
But the thing is, you're dealing, at the time, Brando was making a political statement on the stage. And that's what they were against, because this was not a podium for a political statement.
It was it was before it got to be real chic to do that.
Right.
And I'm kind of
he broke the ice on it.
Yeah, I think they got away from. I'm kind of glad they got away from doing it, though too.
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't want the show to always be a friggin' political soapbox.
Well, they don't want to be a political soapbox for this actor or contestant's, you know, belief of the moment.
But what I respect about that moment was, it wasn't like Marlon Brando getting up there, receiving the award and fitting in, and then saying, oh, by the way, thanks for letting me be a part of your club, and now I want to say the following five things that I'm passionate about. It was Marlon Brando saying, no thank you, you know, I don't belong, and here's something I have to say. Because it seems to me, the Oscars seems to be such a bunch of friggin'...
It is.
Cowards, you know. But something that Brando did was much different than that. He wasn't trying to be accepted.
Right.
So
he had the national spotlight on him at the time, and he knew the cameras weren't going to pull away.
Yeah.
There was no doubt he had
a captive audience.
There was no doubt he deserved to win.
Right.
But the position he was in, for the role that he was in, he would not have had to campaign one bit to get the nomination, to get the award, to win it. So it is very likely that he did nothing to foster.
But he never did
further that cause.
Like, he was frankly lazy. As good as he was a frankly lazy actor.
Yeah.
Especially after the early 60s. I mean, he just mailed it in, you know. But I think it's at least logically consistent to get up on stage and say, you know what? I really don't want your guys' stinking award, because I don't respect you guys enough to want to be part of your club, and this is what I'm going to say about it.
And that's fair.
Yeah. It wasn't like, oh, thanks for showering me with all these compliments and making me a part of your club.
Go save Darth Vader.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like that. It was totally different, which I liked. But that's interesting. Well, I think we've all learned something here today.
Mm-hmm. Well, when Vanessa Redgrave did it, and during her speech many years ago, nobody was very happy about that either. In fact, the host came back with a rather sarcastic comment, like, thank you very much, Vanessa, for your insights. And he said it in such a sarcastic way.
When did that happen?
That was about the 80s. Vanessa Redgrave accepted her Best Actress Award.
For what movie?
I'm trying to... Sophie's Choice.
Okay. It's like 84 or something
like
that?
Yeah, and she did a similar Brando, and it wasn't very accepted by the Academy, or I should say by the audience, but the audience did more or less just sort of seethed. They'd seen this part of the movie before. It was the host who came back with these sarcastic comments.
Interesting. Yeah, well... I don't know. Those stupid Oscars.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting... You never know what's going to happen anymore.
Yeah. All right. I guess that's a wrap then.
Yes.
Yes.
So thank you for sticking with us.
Schindler's List.
This rather long Schindler's List.
And next up is Minority Report.
Oh, yes.
All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.